It's September 7th, 2025. So it's the full moon lunar observance day, what we call the Wan Prat. Monks are called Prat in Thailand. Prat means, it comes from prasert, excellent, means one who is excellent. So that a life that is Prat, that's what the forest monks in Thailand talk about, living a life which is excellent, which comes from Sila Samadhi Panya, the virtue, meditation, discernment, which is a summary of the path. I was just listening to the crickets outside and thinking about Nibbana Nusati, the recollection of peace or the recollection of the goal of practice of Nibbana, and how using the quietude of the forest and just the sounds of the forest can be useful for helping the mind to settle. And sometimes I find it helpful to recollect times where, not necessarily meditating, but for example, I can remember just walking up the hill at a place like Phujomgom in a remote part of Thailand at night, and these same sounds of these crickets. And maybe there's a light breeze, perfect temperature, and just an expanse of rocks, and just incredibly quiet, very, very quiet. Or times when you just go to a remote branch monastery in Thailand and there's just a few monks there, and maybe they're having a katina. It's not such a big place, so maybe there's not so many people that have gathered, and staying up all night and practicing, listening to Dhamma talks. And then there might be some senior monks off to the side, just having a cup of tea or a drink, taking a break from the Dhamma talks. And there's that opportunity to go and speak with them and spend some time with them. And it would also be a very quiet atmosphere like this. So that using our environment to help the mind to settle is very important. I can think of just so many Wan Prat lunar observance days here at Abayagiri over the years, just doing the late night sit, late night vigil, sitting meditation, walking meditation, and just sometimes it would be so quiet and so pleasant outside. The only part that's not quiet is the mind. That's keep us from hearing the beautiful sounds, nature. Or I would think about that, you know, walking down sometimes on the day after the observance day, has been up most of the night in meditation and maybe going for a short rest at my dwelling place, and then walking down and early in the morning, and there's kind of maybe a little bit of mist, and hearing the mountain quails morning time, and walking down and thinking it's like a solitude sound for me. The sound of the mountain quail is a solitary quail. And so that sound that they make is very lovely, I find. And kind of walking down, hearing the sound of the mountain quail through the mist, the call of the mountain quail, and smelling the fresh bay laurel leaves, and thinking, wow, this just being here, the air and the sounds and everything is like medicine for the mind, medicine for the heart. So the Buddha does teach about Dhamma like medicine. This is what we call Dhamma Osata, or the Dhamma medicine. And Lumpur Cha would also talk about this, that he used when he was on Tudong and he thought he was going to die, he decided to use the Dhamma as medicine. And what does that mean, using the Dhamma as medicine? I think it at least partly means just bringing the mind to a state of peace and relying on that and coming back to the refuge of Buddha Dhamma Sangha, or awareness, truth of the way things are, and virtue. Those are the three internal refuges of Buddha Dhamma. That's the inner Buddha, the inner Dhamma, the inner Sangha. So those are the true refuges, the refuges that are important. So that can help us to come to a sense of Nibbana Nusati, a sense of just quiet. Sometimes we might feel like we want to push ourselves in our practice and usually we do need to do that. We need to push a bit. We need to force ourselves a bit, not too much, not overdoing it, but we do need to push the envelope a bit, force ourselves a bit, work through the tiredness a bit. That's the virtue of sitting on the lunar observance days, is actually working through that tiredness. And then the mind can get very bright and energized if we work through that. We don't give in to the tiredness. But then sometimes if the defilements are a little bit more strong, or there's more obstacles coming up for us, those latent karmic obstacles, maybe those are coming up for us, and so it won't be so peaceful. And then the mind can get very tired and exhausted. But that's also not a bad thing. That's good to go through that, necessary to go through that. And I find the longer I'm a monk, then sometimes those experiences of exhaustion are the most insightful, you know, working through that. You know, sometimes the mind is very tired and we can't really figure out why. The mind is very exhausted, can't really figure out why. And it's some sort of karmic obstacle or just something very deep. That's just welling up, and that's a natural result of the practice. I was speaking with Ajahn Ashulo on the phone earlier today, and he's an Australian monk who's an abbot in Thailand. And we were talking about just developing qualities as senior monks and how we look after ourselves, how we learn how to protect our minds from too many external influences, and learning how to just look after ourselves in a way that we don't get too negative, or things don't affect us too much. So we have to find some sort of sustainable way to look after ourselves. He related a story of Lompor Suchitto, actually meeting up with Lompor Suchitto. And when Ajahn Ashulo was more junior, he remembers going and meeting Lompor Suchitto, and he was a bit surprised that even though there was this senior monk, and Lompor Suchitto was the abbot of Chithurst at the time, considered quite a difficult monastery to look after, and a lot of duties, a lot of people to teach, a lot of issues and problems to help people to work through. And Ajahn Ashulo was a little bit taken aback when he first met Lompor Suchitto and saw this bright, radiant being who could laugh easily, quick to laugh, could kind of chide himself. He was very humble and very seemingly lighthearted and fairly unconcerned about things. And yeah, he was able to take on all these duties and be the abbot of Chithurst Forest Monastery. So Ajahn Ashulo at that time, he was Tan Ashulo then, asked him, well, as a abbot, how are you able to maintain this kind of, you know, laughing easily and being very lighthearted, and even though it must be very heavy what you look after? And Ajahn Suchitto's answer was just one word. He said, exhaustion. He just said, exhaustion. So the point being that through this sense of exhaustion, we don't have time to be heavy-hearted. We don't have enough energy to do it. We have to look after ourselves. The exhaustion actually forces us to find those resources to look after ourselves. So either the mind is going to go into negativity, which is totally unsustainable, or just find ways to say, okay, let's just laugh at the situation, not take ourselves too seriously. That's lighthearted, being very lighthearted. And the mind can be very bright if we're able to do that, if we're able to drop things quickly. It's not that we don't care at all, but that we learn how to drop things quickly, develop a mind like water where we can flow into different situations. And you know, for a senior monk, you might meet with one person and they're expressing all sorts of gratitude and it's wonderful to be here, practice is going well, and so on. And then 3 minutes later you meet with the next person, it's really terrible, I hate you. Things are terrible, I'm leaving. Yeah, so I feel like I could feel very elated at the first person and very dejected the second. But then I'm not going to be able to be present for either of those people if that's what's happening. So just using that sense of awareness, I hate you, I want to leave. Then the next person might be, Oh, I want to offer you something. And if I'm too affected by the second person, then it's like, oh, what's wrong? What's wrong? So just kind of being able to be present and available for these situations, but then to, that's one way I think of knower of the worlds. One of the qualities of the Buddha is loka vidu, which is knower of the worlds. And so the Buddha is the ultimate example of being able to be present for all these different realms of existence. There's the heavenly realm, there's the ghost realm, there's the human realm, there's the animal realm, there's the hell realm. And so the Buddha can actually go between these different realms of existence, and he knows them, but he's not swept away by them or absorbed into them. He's transcended them. So he's the knower of the worlds. So we can become, the more we're able to listen, and the more we're able to let go of the sense of self. The sense of self is really, in its essence, it's not actually anything much. What it is a reference point. Ultimately, the sense of self is a reference point. And there's this, so there's a reference point that all of us have that we're putting a lot of effort into propping up and taking care of and nurturing. This sense of self, which is a reference point. So it's hard to see. It's hard to see the sense of self. It's hard to see the reference point that we're actually, even though it's really on the deepest levels of our being, it's how we're, it's why we're reacting to things the way we are. That reference point is the reason, the very MO of how we react to the world around us and how we react to each other. And yet we can't see it. There's something hidden in the background. It's like the conjurer behind the curtain. So there's this reference point. But then there's times in our lives where we are able to see it more clearly. And those times are these like really strong moments that'll happen for us. Say we almost get in a car accident. It's a near miss. And I almost died. So look at, well, what almost died? Or somebody unjustly criticizes us. You know, you're a really terrible person. And say a friend criticizes us in a way that's really cutting, really hurtful. And we think, how could they think that about me? So who is the me? What is the me that we're referring to? So in those moments, the reference point pops out, becomes visible temporarily. But if we can catch it, we need to catch it with mindfulness. We need to be quick. It's like the teaching of the lizard and the termite mound. So there's a termite mound that has six holes, and you want to, you know, there's a lizard somewhere in there, and you want to catch the lizard. So you got to plug up these different holes. The lizard pops its head out from time to time and says, here I am, come try to get me if you can. So you kind of try to grab it and it pops its head back into the hole. So you start plugging the holes, and then eventually there's only one hole left and the lizard can only come out of that hole. So then you can catch it. So that's the analogy for that. It's like the sixth sense bases. So the lizard of the defilements is, it's coming out through the eye, but then it's actually eye, ear, nose, tongue, and body. It's kind of using those five sense bases as a tool. But really, when there's a sense of restraint with those five sense bases, then it's going to come out in the mind, and that's where we catch it. So the reference point is going to come out in the mind. It's the eye, ear, nose, tongue, body. Those are the tools of that reference point. Those are the tools of the sense of self. But really, it's going to display itself in the mind. We can investigate, you know, how are we using our sense bases? What are we focusing on? How are we using our sense bases? How are we relating to the world around us? That can imply through inference, then we can start to see what sort of beliefs, what sort of worldview are we holding deep down inside, our inherently held, deeply held worldview, whether it's a view of karma and rebirth, or it's a view that the body is, you know, everything is annihilated at the time of death, or it's a view that we have a soul and we live forever, or it's a view that we need to be very, very austere to run all of our bad karma out, and then we'll become enlightened. Whatever deeply held view we have, that will inform our actions. So the view of annihilation or nihilism, which some scientific views lead, you know, teach this, that say the mind and consciousness is just a byproduct of the biological being, and that at the time of death, there's just oblivion. And so it doesn't really matter what you do in your life, whether you're a good person or a bad person, it's all going to be the same for everybody at death. And the result, if one deeply holds that view, then the result of that is tending toward hedonism, because, well, might as well get as much pleasure as I can, because it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter who I put out, doesn't matter who I harm, then it doesn't matter, because we're all just heading to oblivion at the end. But then if there's the idea of, say, eternalism, an eternal being, there's some part of us that goes on life after life after life, then that sense of eternalism, or that after death there'll be some sort of eternal heaven or an eternal hell, that the result of that is perhaps a little bit better if we hold that belief. We're going to hopefully hold some sort of virtue, thinking that, well, if I'm a bad person, then I might fall to hell. If I'm a good person, I might go to heaven. So if we deeply hold that belief of an eternal soul, then the actions will tend to be a bit more virtuous. If we hold the view of karma and rebirth, if we believe that and we hold that, and that is our reference that's informing our actions, then that will certainly be a path of virtue, because there will be a really strong sense of what we call Hiriotapa, or the protectors of the world. Hiriotapa is normally translated as shame and fear of wrongdoing, although in English, translating something as shame and fear is not perhaps that helpful. So we could think of it as having a sense of conscience. It's perhaps a better translation for Hiriotapa. Conscience and a sense of compunction, or a sense of the acknowledgement of the results of good and bad actions. So having a sense of conscience, and not only will we want to perform acts of virtue, generosity, kindness, and so on with the time that we have, but also we will want to do whatever we can to bring the mind to a place of peace. So there's the sense of self being a reference point, and then we hear the various teachings of the Thai Ajahns that can break up with the realization of Dhamma. When the reference point breaks up, then there's the Dhamma of no reference. And when we hear about that the insight into not self, it can seem like, okay, that can seem like an annihilation, or it can seem like we'll be very without an anchor and unmoored if that were to happen, if we were to have that type of an insight. So, well, where is the reference? I need some sort of anchor. I need some sort of reference. I need something to rely on. And it's a bit counterintuitive, but actually the result of the realization into not self is the most incredible solidity, confidence. And why is that? It's because when there's that reference point, that sense of self, we're putting a lot of effort into propping it up. We're putting a lot of effort into creating it all the time. We're putting a lot of effort into fabricating it all the time. And there can be deeply held hopes and fears around it being, the sense of self being harmed in some way, hoping that it doesn't get harmed, fearing that it will get harmed, and so on. And then when there's the realization into not self, that reference point was just an illusion all along. It's not that we get rid of our sin. It's not that we get rid of a self that was there. It was never there to begin with. It was just a fantastic illusion. Then there's no need to prop anything up. There's no need to put forth effort into protecting it. There's no need to hope that it's going to not come to harm. There's no need to fear that it is going to come to harm, because there's nothing for these things to land on. There's no attack that could land on anything. There's nothing there to land on. So with the realization of not self, solidity, confidence, sense of imperturbability, that would be the results we would look for if somebody, say, claimed to have an insight into not self. So peace would be the result. One of the things I like to think about also with Nibbana Nusati is actually contemplating what the mind of an arhant might be like. I find that an enjoyable, fun contemplation. In terms of, you know, you think about meditation, like most of us have probably had at least one or two good meditation experiences in our lives. That's what's brought us to the practice, brought us to the monastery, seeing that there is peace and happiness that perhaps is possible to cultivate. But then one of the issues that comes up with the meditation is that we might come to meditation and experience this sense of letting go. And we meditate and we get into a state where we're just in the present moment. We're not hoping for any sort of result. And the mind becomes peaceful and we remember that. And then one of the issues is that then we'll try to recreate that. The original experience came from not trying to create anything. So then we try to recreate that experience. We remember it. So then we try to recreate it. But then the actual experience comes from not trying to create something. Then because it was happiness, it was peace, it was very pleasant, it's only natural that we'll try to recreate it. And then even if we think, oh, I'm not supposed to be trying to recreate it, we're going to subconsciously hope for it, and that's going to block it as well. So the first time, it was like we weren't hoping for it because we didn't know anything was going to happen. So we weren't hoping for it, and we weren't trying to create anything. And so the mind experienced happiness. So, oh, that's interesting. But then after that, we hope for it, we try to create it, and so on. Eventually, perhaps 5-10 years later, you know, we give up and it happens again. So we give up and then the mind feels happy again. Okay, that's interesting. So it's the art of practice. So coming back to the contemplation of what the mind of an arhant might be like, just think about if the mind was able to just have that sense of giving up and letting go, which leads to that natural happiness and settling. But then the mind doesn't cling to that. And when the mind doesn't cling to that, then the happiness and the settling goes deeper. And then the mind still doesn't cling to that, and it goes even deeper. And then the mind still doesn't cling to it ever. And that would be a recollection of the mind of an arhant, because there's no clinging for an arhant. So that happiness and peace that comes from non-clinging, it's experienced, and then there's no clinging to that either. And so at that point, I would think that it would transmute into something else other than just peace. And that's where the Buddha talks about freedom. The taste of Dhamma is the taste of freedom. So absolute freedom. So the recollection of the mind of an arhant is the recollection of a mind that is absolutely free. Absolutely free of any sense of dissatisfaction, any sense of hope and fear, any sense of worry. It's absolutely free. So it's not just peace, but it even transcends peace, I would think, just because that would be the nature of not clinging. That would be the nature of the mind that isn't picking anything up, the way of non-suffering. We can get little inklings of that, I think, with the listening to the crickets, doing our walking meditation, doing our sitting meditation, just to recollect these things. And when the mind does calm down a bit and things go quiet temporarily, just to be able to rest in that and have a sense of delight in that. And if we can just be okay with, if it doesn't become something super profound or the mind starts to cling and picks it up in a way that causes it to not go any deeper, that's okay. That's just the mind, that's where it's at. And the more we can just accept that the mind is at where it's at, just let the process unfold. That's a Nibbana Nusati, that's Sangha Nusati. It's a recollection of arhants. It would be very helpful when we do our practice in the Lunar Observance Days. So I think that's probably enough for the time this evening. I'll leave that for reflection this evening.